You're listening to NPR on Science. I'm David Malikoff, an editor on NPR's Science Desk. This week, stories on sex, robots, and the wind. First up, sex. A writer named Mary Roach has written a book entitled Bonk, The Curious Coupling of Science and Sex. It's both a little clinical and a little comical. NPR's Robert Siegel recently talked with Mary Roach about bonking.
A warning, this interview includes references, mostly sober references, to sex organs and also to polyester. In Bonk, Roach explores the current state and the history of research into human sexuality, and she drafts her husband into service as a study subject with her. She also introduces readers to trailblazers in the field, some of whom I'd heard of, Alfred Kinsey, Masters and Johnson, but there were some I hadn't heard of, like Robert Latou Dickinson, a Brooklyn-based physician.
Robert Latou Dickinson was a phenomenal man. He was a gynecologist working in the 1890s through about the 1930s. He's actually the man who got Kinsey interested in sex. Kinsey had been studying gall wasp speciation, had no inkling of what lay ahead for him, then met this man, Robert Latou Dickinson. In his gynecological practice, Dickinson began asking patients systematically about their sex lives and not, you know, how is it, but what do you do and how do you have an orgasm and how are things going for you? And so he had these detailed case studies, and he began to see that there were a lot of very unhappy and unsatisfied people, and he began going further along and actually started doing some physiological testing. And back then there wasn't a lot of fancy equipment, so Dr. Dickinson at one point became interested in what exactly goes on inside people when they're having sex, and he used a test tube. He actually inserted it and would shine a light so he could actually see what was going on in there, that if the test tube were standing in for the penis, then you would see, you know, where is it hitting? Is it hitting the cervix? And there was, at the time, it was believed that the penis actually interlocked with the cervix, which is not true, and he could see that, in fact, it wasn't even hitting anywhere near the head of the cervix, and he was able to sort of debunk the coital interlocking theory. So he was really the first man to take a really scientific laboratory approach to figuring out what happens when people have sex.
And he was doing this in the early decades of the 20th century. And he, I mean, do we know if lots of his patients were turning him down and were put off by these questions, or were they all?
As far as I could tell, they were amazingly cooperative. I went into one of the archives where his some of his files are, and he kept these detailed note cards with the responses that people were giving him. And they were very, very forthcoming and seemed to have no qualms about it. And this is, I think, actually, the 1920s were a surprisingly open-minded and freewheeling era. This was before the 40s and 50s when we swang back the other way. The 1920s, there were sex manuals at the time that were encouraging women to try being on top. They were talking about the clitoris. The 1920s were almost like the 60s in a way, and then we swang back to a more conservative era.
Now, as you said, Dr. Dickinson, Dr. Robert Latou Dickinson, was the person whose work inspired Alfred Kinsey. In passing, you note, I'm reading a quote now. I give you a sentence, my favorite sentence in the entire oeuvre of Alfred Kinsey from Sexual Behavior in the Human Female. Quote, cheese crumbs spread in front of a copulating pair of rats may distract the female, but not the male.
That's my favorite, yes. He was making the point that the female, the human female he was talking about, is more prone to distraction during sex. He was talking about, in general, the male and the female to a certain extent. When you're very, very aroused, a tremendous amount of stuff can be going on around you and you won't notice. Your peripheral vision kind of cuts out. You don't notice if somebody's, you know, picking your pocket, and prostitutes have used this to great benefit. You don't feel pain nearly as much. Mm-hmm. Something that would be painful otherwise is just sort of registers as a mild tactile stimulation. So anyway, it was in that passage of the book that he mentioned the copulating rats and the cheese crumbs.
One of the more exotic studies that you write about was published in, was it European Urology, by an Egyptian doctor?
Yes. That was my favorite study of all time. Dr. Shafik, he's an extraordinary gentleman in that he funds his own research. He's a surgeon, but he's done a lot of research in the realm, the whole pelvic area. So he's done proctology, urology, andrology, sexology. And I came across him kind of arbitrarily. I found this paper in which he was looking at the effects of polyester fabric on the fertility and incidence of copulation in rats. And
I didn't know that rats wore polyester.
They don't, but in Dr. Shafik's lab, he actually outfitted laboratory rats in tiny little polyester trousers. And there's a little diagram in the paper. And this is a legitimate research paper published in a peer-reviewed journal. And there's a line drawing of a rat wearing these tiny little trousers. And on the caption says, "The underpant worn by the rat."
I gather Dr. Shafik passed away last year, you told me.
Yes, in October he passed away.
And he found in that particular study that wearing polyester, wearing polyester diminished the fertility of the rats, but you at least admit the possibility that perhaps he was just wearing anything, or dressing funny might also diminish the fertility of anyone.
Yes, the incidence of copulations, I think whether you're a rat or a human male wearing those trousers, I mean, you kind of need to see the trousers, but there's a little hole for the tail and their drawstring at the top, and they're not very attractive, and I think it would be kind of hard to get a date in that case, yes.
Well, after meeting people like Dr. Shafik in Cairo and you and your husband taking part in a study with Dr. Deng in London and so many other interviews you report on in the book, I mean, what do you come away? What's the takeaway knowledge you have from having written Bonk?
Well, I think that one of the things that I'm left with is a lingering sense of surprise that there are still a good number of mysteries in the realm of sexual physiology. You kind of have the sense as a person who has sex, you figure, well, you know, it seems to work. What else do we need to know? Which is kind of a ridiculous attitude. That would be like somebody saying to a person who's studying, say, the esophageal sphincter, well, we all know how to eat. Why do we need to study that? So I come up against that all the time. People saying, well, what's the point of this research? You know, tell me something I don't know about sex. We don't know, for example, the mechanisms of ejaculation, what the trigger is for that. And there have been all kinds of elaborate and quite frightening little studies that have been done in that realm. Just any number of things that we really should still be looking into, and yet it's very difficult for sex researchers to get funding for purely anatomical and physiological research these days.
Well, Mary Roach, author of Bonk, The Curious Coupling of Science and Sex, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
If you go to NPR.org, you can also hear Mary Roach describe her experience as an ultrasound guinea pig. Now, robots. Before I heard this story, I had no idea that there was a Robot Hall of Fame, and I had no idea that there was a debate over exactly which robots deserve to get in. But thanks to Nell Greenfield Boyce, who works with me here on the Science Desk, I now have a much fuller appreciation of the ins and outs of selecting robot all-stars. She brought this story back from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Right now, the Robot Hall of Fame has no physical hall you can walk through. That will come next year when the Carnegie Science Center in Pittsburgh opens a new exhibit. Tonight, the center is just hosting a party. Right inside the door, guests are greeted by what seems to be an astonishing little robot called Quasi.
Oh, you guys want to hear some awesome robot jokes?
Yeah.
What do you call a robot who's always getting lost? R2-D-Tor.
It's amazing how many people think, wow, artificial intelligence has really come of age. It's like, no, it's an actor. There's an actor behind it.
Don Marinelli says Quasi is not actually a robot. It's a high-tech puppet. Marinelli is a drama professor at Carnegie Mellon University, which founded the Robot Hall of Fame. He says people are so used to seeing robots in movies and TV that they now have totally unrealistic expectations of what a robot should be able to do in real life. So this was the first controversy faced by the builders of the Robot Hall of Fame. Should they include famous fake robots or just real ones?
There was a real concern that the fictional robots would skew people's expectations so that when they saw a robot that did widgets, it would seem somehow less impressive than Gort, which could incinerate the Earth.
Gort, of course, is from the movie The Day the Earth Stood Still, and he's in the Hall of Fame, because it turns out the Hall will accept fantasy robots, along with real-world ones like Unimate, the first industrial robot. It did dull, repetitive work on a GM assembly line in 1961. Marinelli is on a jury of distinguished scientists and artists who get together every year to decide what else should be in the hall.
there is definitely tension and conflict when it comes to deciding who should get in first.
One exception was when jury member Arthur C. Clarke nominated one of his own fictional creations.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
No one said, "I can't do that" to Clarke, even though Hal is usually considered a computer.
Nobody was willing to say, "But Sir Arthur, Hal is a lens and a red light." I mean, we didn't want to go there. It was like, sure, Hal, why not?
Sometimes robots that don't win can feel hurt.
And rather cruelly, R2-D2 was one of the first inductees.
Anthony Daniels says it was cruel because he played the other famous Star Wars robot, C-3PO, the tall golden one that wasn't in the first group of inductees. He says C-3PO wasn't bitter exactly.
He just noticed it and was a little silent when R2 came home boasting with his memorial plaque that he'd been given. But all was right the next year.
That's because the next year, C-3PO got in too. And now, the man inside the gold suit serves as Master of Ceremonies.
For the Robot Hall of Fame, Anthony Daniels!
This year, only one fictional invention got in. Lieutenant Commander Data from Star Trek. He was joined by real robots, like Mindstorms, the popular Lego kit, plus NavLab 5. That's a high-tech minivan that drove itself from Pittsburgh to San Diego in 1995. Another inductee was the Raybert Hopper, a one-legged robot invented by Mark Raybert in the early 1980s.
All it does is hop around in a lab, go back and forth.
But Raybert says the Hopper pioneered new ideas about balance and motion that let other robots walk in a much more natural way. So even though this electronic pogo stick will look incredibly humble next to famous sci-fi characters in the Robot Hall of Fame, it's just the kind of real-world technology that might someday make them a reality. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
Our final story is about the power of the wind and the fragility of family. It's part of a series we've been doing called Shifting Ground about land use. All of the stories in Shifting Ground are reported by independent producer David Barron. This story comes from New York State, which is home to one of the country's largest wind farms. Now, I've seen that farm, and I can tell you that the turbines are actually quite beautiful from a distance. But David Barron discovered when he went there that wind power can get a bit ugly, and he has this story of a family that was blown apart by the wind.
A snow-covered road rises from the Black River Valley onto Tug Hill in Lewis County, New York. This is Yancey Road, home to the Yancey family for generations.
My parents lived here and my grandfather lived here.
John Yancey has lived here his whole life. He's 48, and he's not pleased with the recent changes in the neighborhood.
We've got nothing but windmills.
Windmills surround him.
We'll start here on the north. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 7,
the turbines
8,
are
9,
white, sleek, 10, enormous, 20 stories tall, with blades three times longer than a Greyhound bus.
42, 43.
Almost 200 turbines sprawl across an area larger than Manhattan. This is the Maple Ridge Wind Farm, the largest wind power facility in the East. It opened 2 years ago, and it's transformed the way this rural area looks and sounds.
You'll hear that whoosh, whoosh, whoosh.
John Yancey says when the wind comes from the right direction, the sound penetrates his house, his bedroom, his consciousness.
I don't sleep.
Most of the noise comes from one turbine. It's just across the street. And what makes it especially upsetting, the turbine is on his father's land.
I asked him not to have it installed there, to ask the company to either move it or delete it. But they built it, and now I have to suffer with it.
John and a couple of his brothers are angry at their father for allowing 7 turbines on his land. One brother, Herb Yancey, grows corn and hay on his father's farm. He says the wind towers and their access roads have fragmented the land.
And now you have all these little fields with no straight borders on them any place. It made farming a nightmare.
Then there's their brother Gordon. He owns a nearby inn that's popular with snowmobilers. He used to enjoy an unobstructed view of the Adirondacks. Now he looks out on the wind towers.
They've taken away my peacefulness, my serenity, my ability to walk outside on my property and enjoy the quietness of the morning sun, the quietness of the setting sun.
And Gordon barely speaks to his father anymore.
I feel that he sold the family out.
My name is Edward Yancey. I was born in 1916.
Ed Yancey's hearing isn't so good, and when I ask him about the turbines that have divided him from his sons, it's not clear he understands. But there's a simple reason he agreed to windmills on his land. He receives lease payments of more than $45,000 a year.
It helps out. Helps pay the taxes.
His daughter, Virginia Yancey Leindecker, sides with her father in this family dispute. She says he would have been foolish not to lease his land for wind towers.
My theory is, if you're going to, they're all going to be around you, and you're going to see them. And if you got the property, you might as well partake, because why should you go and say, I'm too important to take money?
Money, fairness, a sense that decisions were not made democratically. These are the core issues that explain the Yancey family rift, and it's a rift that split the broader community, too. Many people here like the wind farm. It's brought jobs and tax dollars. Some consider the turbines beautiful. But resentment has bubbled up because those who have a lot of land and a lot of windmills make a lot of money, while their land-poor neighbors receive next to nothing.
It has caused friction, family against family or neighbor against neighbor.
Arlie Rice is town supervisor for Lowville, New York, one of the three towns that host the Maple Ridge Wind Farm. Wind projects have now been proposed for other communities in the region, and residents of those towns often seek his advice.
When I go other places, I say, just sit down and think how you can benefit everyone.
Okay, well, let's do this. Why don't you come up and get a sheet of paper and a marker?
That question, how to make wind power something everyone can benefit from, was put recently to an eighth-grade science class at Lowville's middle school. The teacher, Debbie Yancey, Herb's wife, Ed's daughter-in-law. She broke the students into teams.
Okay, and we're talking windmills, guys, windmills.
The students came up with several ideas for improving wind farm development. Among them, require that windmills be set back farther from neighboring homes. Hold a town vote on whether to allow the project. And don't let wind power companies negotiate deals one-on-one with individual landowners.
They got to do it as a community thing.
They have to do it as a community thing.
Yeah. It'd make the windmills better because
the community would get that money.
And then they could figure out where they wanted to plant them. If someone didn't want it, it didn't need to be there. It could go somewhere else.
Go somewhere else, okay. So everybody's kind of all in it together.
It's a win-win situation.
A win-win situation.
But wind power does involve trade-offs, and they're not always easy. How do you weigh the potential harm to neighbors against the benefit to the planet? Is it worth giving up the view you're used to in exchange for economic gains? Such questions don't just divide communities and families. They sometimes leave individuals internally conflicted. John Yancey, who's so upset about the windmill across the street that keeps him up nights, he's a union electrician. He helped build the wind towers.
They needed manpower, and our union supplied it.
Did you work on the ones on your dad's land?
Yes, I did. I thought that it possibly would be something that I'd be proud to say that, yes, I helped build this turbine across the road, but now I'm eating my words.
And now that the windmills have come, John Yancey says he may go and leave his home on Yancey Road. For NPR News, I'm David Barron.
If you want to see some pictures of John Yancey and his family and those wind turbines, you can go to NPR.org. You can also find some more stories about science, the environment, and technology. For NPR on Science, I'm David Malikoff. If you'd like to hear more stories about science or the environment or technology, go to npr.org. For NPR on Science, I'm David Malakoff.